This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Becca and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Good morning.
We have a great show for you this week. This week we are interviewing 13th Age content creator and writer of The King of Dungeons, Baz Stevens. Baz, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Good morning. Whatever time zone you're in. Hello, everybody.
It's 8 a.m. here.
Yep.
It's a beautiful 3 p.m. here. The sun is shining.
Well, thank you for working with us and aligning multiple time zones so that we could talk about King of Dungeons. I have been very excited about today. We're interviewing you, and then after the interview, we're doing our review of The King of Dungeons. But for those of our listeners who may not know you, how did you get into gaming?
You can probably tell from the accent, so I'm from the UK. And much like everybody else in the UK of a certain age, it's all due to Games Workshop. Everything in the UK is down to Games Workshop. And in the very early 80s, I think it actually was 1980, I was introduced to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons via a school club. And that would have been, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons with the big old hardback books. And all of the other role-playing stuff that got imported into Europe via Games Workshop under their own imprint, stuff like Judge Dredd, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, that kind of stuff. So yeah, from the age of about 11 years old, I took up Red Box D&D pretty early on, and 40 odd years later, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Mark and I are nodding here with you. That feels about right.
I love that you refer to it as Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, not just first edition, it's Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
AD&D was a completely different beast.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was. I mean, people seem to think if you're old school these days that basic D&D was what everybody was playing. And I think that is true to an extent, but everything got blended. There wasn't that much in the hobby anyway. We had bits of RuneQuest in our games. We even had bits of Traveller in our games. We were slightly pompous about it. We never said we were playing basic, because why would you do that if there's a game with advanced in the title?
That's right. I feel like it was a bit of dirty pool on Gygax's part, because no one wants to play basic if you could play advanced. Like,
that's right. You can either have stupid D&D or clever D&D.
That's right.
So how did you get into podcasting?
I've been lucky enough to have some people in my gaming group for decades now. And at university in the 90s, we used to do what a lot of people do, which is play for a whole weekend, play right through the night. And sometimes those sessions were great and sometimes they weren't. But the bit that was always good about it was I would stay up with my friend Gaz, and we would stay up for another few hours, probably longer than the gameplay sometimes. And we'd open a bottle of whiskey and we would put the gaming world to rights. And the only trouble with that was that the technology level meant that we couldn't remember anything we'd said the next day. So we solved everything, honestly. You know, we would just stay up all night and like rewrite Blue Planet so it made sense. And the next day it was all lost. So when we found out that you could record stuff, we thought we would just do that for our own amusement, really. And then we're 100 episodes in now. We've interviewed Jonathan Tweet and Mike Merles and everybody in the UK. And for some reason, we haven't run out of things to discuss yet. And we're still trying to, as I said before, we're still trying to put the gaming world to rights. And we just like talking about games. And sometimes that's more fun than the game. You know, those sort of post-match analyses are really good fun. And it turns out we've got an audience who just like to hear about this stuff too.
Now, what is the name of your show and where can people find you online?
Okay, so you can get us at whatwoulthesmartpartydo.com. No need for the question mark. It's obviously rhetorical.
I really like that title. It speaks to me.
I feel like it speaks to the DM in me as the player. Right. I'd be like, we are the smart party, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Why would you ever call yourself the stupid party?
That's right. Why would you call yourself the basic party? We're the advanced party.
Yeah, that's it. It's a little bit knowing, as most of our games are these days. But when you find yourself in a bad position and the poor GM sitting there for at least half an hour thinking, are you guys going to do something soon? Because I've got real dilemmas and encounters just waiting for you to like step up and play. So what would the smart party do at this stage? Yeah, they would go to the swamp on their own at night, because that's what the game is about. So let's do it.
Whenever I run Shadowrun as the GM, I'm always sitting there because it's like 3 hours of intense planning that I know they're not actually going to use. As soon as they walk through the door, they're just going to like spray and pray. And I'm like, oh, can we just get to that part? Because I have all of that figured out. We'll do all of the talking.
Yeah.
The party's never bothered. They don't do that outside the door, at least for the Red Dragon. They treat that like it's some kind of broom closet. You know, they just like go and blunder it. But when it comes to the broom closet, that takes like 3 weeks of careful planning and miniature placement.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Exactly. So what games are you playing right now?
Well, I'm just back from a local convention, local by American standards. It took me 3 hours to drive there. Which one was that last weekend? And that was called Owlbear and Wizard Star, which is a really good little Twitter meetup thing. About 100 guys there, maybe a dozen tables. And I ran King of Dungeons for the morning session, which is super cool. And then in the afternoon, I played a game which I have never played before. And it's based on the Cypher system by Monty Cook Games. And it's a game called Vert, V-U-R-T. Mm-hmm. Based on the Jeff Noon sci-fi novel, which I think must be from back in the 90s now, where you suck feathers and go into a strange virtual landscape. It's kind of like Cyberpunk meets Alice in Wonderland. And I was left utterly baffled all the way through it. And I'm no wiser now, a week down the line. But it was a really good time. We enjoyed it.
But isn't that a feature with Vert as opposed to a bug?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really easily confused, okay? Really easily confused. As a player, I'm just awful. I can't do investigations or murder mysteries. They just don't work for me because I'm too stupid to be able to figure out what's going on. So sometimes when a scenario goes for weird, I really like weird in games. I think stuff like Dungeon Crawl Classics is a great example of, like, you know, some slightly bizarre happenings. But weird can very easily get confusing. The thing I have to work on is just trying to keep things in a reasonably straight line so that I have some concept of what to do when it gets to be my turn. And I slightly lost the plot, literally lost the plot in Vert. It was running away from the time.
So when you play, what kind of character is your favorite to play?
It's always some kind of remix of the Black Widow, essentially.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I try as hard as I might. And I do like to sort of like go off script a little bit. But you know, like when you go to a restaurant and you think, you know what, I don't think I will have the bacon cheeseburger today. I always do. Maybe I'll get a noodle salad or something like that. And you have it and it's nice. But you think, I wish I'd had my bacon cheeseburger that I always have. So I end up returning to like rogue-like characters who are like hopefully, you know, quite sharp-witted and have got like one-liners for everything. And they're a little bit sassy and a bit fragile too. So that's kind of like my default character, and no matter what I tried to play. I mean, I played a robot dog in Vert, so maybe that's why it was a bit hard.
Didn't you play a mutant dog in the Fallout playtest, Becca?
Yes, I did. I played
Dogmeat. I did too.
Dogmeat, yeah.
I played Dogmeat too in Modiphius's game.
It was great. I was playing with people I didn't know, and I just growled at them the whole time.
That'll do it. Maybe I should have done that. I'm very obedient and silent.
Right.
You said you were running games at the convention, King of Dungeons, and then playing in some others. Generally speaking, which do you prefer to do? Do you prefer to run the games or play the games?
I find myself running far more than playing. I'm lucky enough to have a fairly regular weekly group. Well, I call it a weekly group. We meet up at least twice a year. And at least, even if we don't need to. And it's comprised mostly of GMs, so I'm kind of like very, very lucky, but also very lucky they let me GM more than anything else. So I love doing that. That's my favorite activity. But every time I GM, I learn something about how to play. Mm-hmm. And then I go do some playing, and every time I play, I learn something about GMing. So I try and keep it fresh by getting involved in other people's games as much as possible, because it teaches you so much about what it's like to be on the other side of the screen.
What is it about GMing that keeps you coming back?
My kind of personality type is I'm kind of an introvert, but I love showing off, which is a really weird combination. So you get to do all of that lonely fun of like world creation and characters and thinking what if and doing a bit of crafting, you know, whether that be like, you know, putting together some stuff online or coming up with tokens and documents, that kind of stuff. And then because, you know, I want to kind of let people see it, you take it out to a table and then just watching four, five, or six other human beings completely tear it apart and reassemble it in a creative way that you couldn't possibly imagine. And you find yourself playing a game. You know, it's I love being the GM in those times where you're kind of not needed in a way, and you can just spectate on the chaos, the lunacy, the creativity that people are coming up with, and stuff that just didn't exist a few hours ago. You know, it's literally being made up out of nothing. That's incredible, you know. As much as I like writing, recording, you know, doing that kind of stuff, it can be quite a lonely existence. You put six people around the table, you have to live with the fact it's not going to be your particular vision, which is actually a feature, not a bug, and then you just watch it blossom. It doesn't always work, but when it does, it's marvelous. That's what keeps you coming back for decades.
My players always joke, oh, that's where JM lost control of the game. I'm like, I don't come in control of the game. I just throw like all of the fireworks and matches out there and see which ones you guys light. So
yeah. If you're a control freak, then GMing might look like it's the thing that would really interest you, but it's like the worst possible environment to be a control freak. I mean,
it's so true.
There was this great, I don't know if it was a Reddit thread or a Facebook post, but it was, you know, the kind of the fundamentalist view of D&D where the GM tells the players what to do and they have complete control over the characters. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, what really happens in D&D? All right, you've talked to the duck for 4 hours. Can you please just cross the river? Please, I'm begging you.
No one could seduce the duck. Please stop.
Yeah.
So you have put out The King of Dungeons, and I just need to tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed reading The King of Dungeons. I don't think I've laughed out loud at a role-playing book in quite a long time.
Yes, your footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
I love them.
So
it's a nod to Sir Terry Pratchett there.
Yes, I definitely picked up on that. What?
See, right now I just want to fly to England and play in Baz's game.
I know, right? Like next year, that'll be our iconic trip. We haven't had an iconic trip, but.
Yeah,
next year we'll do it. So what is King of Dungeons?
King of Dungeons is three things. It is it's three things kind of joined together, which were projects. Like most people, I have a whole bunch of stuff bubbling away on the hard drive or in notebooks. And for a long time, I've been a huge fan of 13th Age. I remain a huge fan of 13th Age. It's one of those games that just really inspired me to get writing. I did some fan supplement stuff for 13th Age back in the day. Actually, I think before the book was out, I was writing it off the playtest document. I liked it that much. So I was working on a basic version of that, going back to our conversation about the difference between advanced Dungeons & Dragons and basic Dungeons & Dragons. I think 13th Age, for all of its good stuff, is still quite a hefty tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like, you know, sort of something that's a bit more stripped down just to make it easier for me to pitch to people. I run a lot for new guys. And as demos, even though 13th Age got a lot going for it, it could have done with being a bit slicker from my perspective. So I was just trying to tinker with the system like we would do. The other thing I had bubbling away was a setting idea, which is really more of a campaign framework than a setting. I've kind of got enough settings, and everybody's got enough settings. I look at my shelves and they are like, you know, they are bowing under the weight of Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms and Dark Sun and Simbaroom and everything else in the Third Imperium and all of those huge encyclopedias of full-color travel guides to distant worlds. They're great, but again, they're a bit impenetrable sometimes. And I don't have time in my life to read another 300-page book about gold smelting and basket weaving. So I wanted to do two things. So a basic 13th Age framework and a setting or structure that would assist people to get something out of their current game collection. And then the third thing I wanted to do was I wanted to just write a book that was conversational in tone. So off the back of, like, you know, our podcasting stuff, where we got most of it done in audio, it's so much easier to just talk things through. But sometimes when you're reading game books, and I love game books, they can be a little bit dry because they have to be a textbook as much as anything mm-hmm. else, or an art book, or an inspiration book. And I wanted to like dump that whole what is role-playing chapter, because I cannot imagine that some 11-year-old is wandering into a store and picking up my book and going, I'll take a pun on this, let's see what happens. I just think the audience knows what one of those is. And then talk to the audience like they know what one of these things is. So I always end up picking up games when people on podcasts like yourselves or friends, they recommend something to me. And I go, oh, cool, what's it like? And then they tell me. They don't read the book out to me. They just tell me what they think of it. And I wanted the whole book to be in that tone. So I wanted to supply people with a stripped down 13th page in a structure that means that they can just get some leverage out of their knowledge, and in a way that even if they don't play it, it's an entertaining read and it's just one gamer talking to another.
Cool.
Well, I think you succeeded on that last point. I definitely feel like you took the conversational tone of 13th Age, where we have the sidebars from Rob and Jonathan, and dialed that up to 11.
It's a lot of things to do when you don't have to have anyone answer you back.
Right. Right.
So, like, Rob and Jonathan stuff, I mean, 13th Age, one of the things I loved about it was that conversational tone. You know, just how lovely to feel like you've been on the conversation. But when you're doing it solo, you just go a little bit crazy. You're just talking to the world.
So what was your favorite change that you did to lighten it up?
Well, it's strange. I mean, lightening up 13th Age was tricky because there's so many moving parts that all connect to each other quite nicely. And I feel like such a heretic when I'm going to say this, okay? And this is not a selling point, so, but, you know, what can I do? Let me be honest. The best bits about 13th Age are stuff like the icons and the backgrounds, escalation dice, you know, all those little bits that you can port into any game, really. And love those things. But you know what? They cause me grief. They cause me a bit of a tough time when I'm introducing the game to noobs. So, you know, backgrounds is wonderful, but people just don't know what to put. They just don't know what to say. And I've ended up running so many con games where those bits have just been left blank until halfway through the session. It's, you know, it's, we're not all Jonathan Tweet or Rob Hinesho. We can't all come up with, like, you know, royal cuisine as a background, which is just one I've made up off the top of my head and sounds pretty good, actually. But most people can't do that. And you end up wanting to say, oh, can I just put stealthy? And that just feels like a waste. So, in stripping back some of the things, icons is another example of just such a wonderful system that even experienced GMs do sort of have to grapple with icon roles. It's not always intuitive. And I have to admit, this is the heresy in it, that I do sometimes drop icon roles and stuff like that from my scenarios. So I kind of stripped those sections and replaced them with just something that I found a bit easier to run. So I don't have icons, but I do have alignments, and those alignments are really loose, and they're just, you know, 9 words that I came up with, which just to speak to me about the kind of style of the style of role-playing characters. I've got civilization, gods, magic, savagery, nature, just things like that. And you slip that down, and there's no dice rolling to go with that, but it is essentially an icon system, because the icon system is essentially an alignment system. And it just worked beautifully. The game I ran last week, I had 2 warriors, or fighters, I suppose. They were absolutely functionally identical apart from 2 words. And the guys playing them didn't know that they were identical at other ends of the table. One was human, one was an infernal. And that doesn't mean much in mechanics. It just means that, you know, you've got a bit of demon blood in your alliance somewhere. And one had civilization as its alignment, and one had savagery. And the 2 characters over the course of that next 3 hours could not have been more different just based on that. They were played in such different ways. The guys decided to describe their characters in different ways. We had one that was going full on barbarian with loincloth and great axe, you know, covered in the blood of his enemies, dragging his heads around on a spike. And the other guy was like black, sort of chitinous beetle-like armor, and had a slight lilac tinge to his skin and smelt slightly of brimstone wherever he went, and was super charming. And this is just based off a couple of words. So that lightening, when you take some of that stuff away, for some people, they find that inspiring. And that was my favorite thing that came out of the game, is that you could have less on the sheet, have less in the book, and somehow bizarrely see more at the table.
There is something to be said for, it's a lot easier to be creative within a framework or within bounds than sort of an unbounded creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. Like I said, I'm not a very clever person. You know? So if people give me 3 choices, I'm happier than when they say you can do anything.
Yeah, I like that the civilization and savagery, it's easier for players to, okay, I'm a savage, to describe it than you're chaotic evil. They just don't get it. You know, the whole alignment system is still very confusing.
Oh, the alignment system is 45 years of argument about it now. It'll never be solved. But what I like, I really like words. I really like words. I'm a teacher by day, and words are kind of like my stock in trade. And I love being able to just look down and see a word on a character sheet where, if I'm not feeling terribly inspired, or it's that bit of the game where the GM says, hey, why don't you just all introduce yourselves? One thing I cannot stand is, and I'm guilty of it myself, people going, Well, I've got an 18 in dexterity. Has anybody else got 18 in dexterity? That's not how people introduce themselves, you know. But it's far more likely, you know, that I like people to see, they see that one word on their character sheet, which might be their alignment, civilization. They start thinking, oh, that means I probably live in a city and I like roads and hot baths and laws and stuff like that. Or they might look next to their constitution, which is like 5, and it might say, like, you know, hacking cough. And that's how they would introduce themselves, by just looking into those words. Tiny little phrases, but a big springboard for the description.
It sort of goes back to one of my favorite old D&D stories, where they were doing the Dragonlance playtest and the mage had what, like a 6 or a 7 in constitution. And so he came up with, oh, I have golden skin and I have this racking cough and I have to keep drinking these potions. And that's sort of how Raistlin was born, mm-hmm. who's one of the iconic, you know, old D&D characters. And it's all because somebody put some thought into, you know, what would this actually mean? And you've kind of codified that.
Mm, that those bits are super cool. I'm not like, you know, I'm not hard boiled at old school with 3d6 down the line. That's not really the way I roll these days. But I do find it fun to play what other people consider to be a disadvantage.
Yeah,
that's just role playing. You know, this just gives me some ammunition to get gaming with. And it's probably easier than some of the advantages that a game might give you. I can't really role play with a potion so easily. You know, a potion of giant strength. I can't really do much with that.
So you had a great Kickstarter, way overfunded, total of 777 backers, which was awesome. You had a stretch goals for upcoming adventures. What are your thoughts on what those might look like and when they may come out?
So they're coming together now quite slowly, but that's the nature of the beast, because now I'm working with like 5 other guys. So I'm doing the first one, and that's nearly ready. And that's going to be like your traditional sort of starter adventure, starter charter. And that one's ready to go. That's the one I ran last week at the convention. So that's been play tested quite a few times now. And it's going to come with a stack of pre-generated characters and guilds as well. So it's really, it probably should have been a chapter in the original book, if I'm being completely honest. But it's not, but it's going out to all the backers. So they're going to get that. And then we're looking to link together another 4 or 5 adventures that will take you across all the levels and the 3 different tiers of playing King of Dungeons. So it will start being scrapping around in abandoned temples looking for gold coins, and it will take people up to like running citywide operations and then nationwide stuff where they're working for government agencies and doing stuff that kind of underpins reality at the very end of it. So these things are going to come together slowly, but as we get each one done in sequence, I'll put them out individually to the backers so you guys won't have to wait. And I guess the long-term goal for that is to compile them all into one big campaign. Love campaigns, and you know, maybe I'll dip back into Kickstarter at that point. Of course, all the current backers will get all of that stuff anyway, but I have a feeling that it might be a nice thing to put together into maybe in my dreams, maybe a nice little box set for the handouts. That'd be really cool.
Well, just so you know, we would all be on board with that idea. We all love box sets.
Just take more of our money.
That's right. That's all it takes. I'm doing it now.
That's right. Well, even just what you were saying, when I read through King of Dungeons, what I really wanted to do was take out my old Thieves World box set and run Sanctuary, but use the King of Dungeons in Sanctuary.
Do it. That's what it's for. Yeah. That's absolutely what it's for. I don't give you Sanctuary. You've got Sanctuary, or you've got that Shan in Eberron. You've got those things already. They're weighing down your shelves. Get them back out. Play them.
So where can listeners find or follow you in the interwebs?
Probably. You're welcome to come around anytime. Kettle's always on. So you can
excellent.
Do that. but if you want to find me on the internet, the probably best way to find me is on Twitter. My handle is Gentle Bazenstern, which was a name given to me by Kenneth Haidt. And if nothing else happens to me in my life, I can always stand by that. So, you know, the world's greatest role-playing writer gave me a nickname, so I'm using it. Baz Stevens, you find me on Twitter under that. WhatWouldTheSmartPartyDo.com will get you onto the podcast that comes out every couple of weeks. And me and my friend Gaz, I've always got something to say on there. And that's probably the best thing you can do. Or you can just email me direct at bazofdungeons@gmail.com. And I'll always come back to any question or query at all.
Well, we'll put all of those in the show notes so our listeners can find you easily. And last but not least, where can people find King of Dungeons?
hop onto Drive-Thru. It's on Drive-Thru. There's print on demand. I can absolutely swear to the quality of these things. I was genuinely very, very surprised at how good the hardbacks come out. I've been told it's a good pricing system, so the PDF's available. I think it's on there for $10 at the moment, which is not too bad for a complete game. But Drive-Thru, just search The King of Dungeons. I'm cursing myself putting the word the bun. I thought it might say make it sound elegant and regal, but actually it's just a painting.
Second printing.
yeah, exactly. Have a look there. You'll find it. Yeah.
All right. Well, we will put that in the show notes. Baz, thanks for coming on the show. Any My final pleasure. Thoughts or comments?
Yeah, Player Scholar. They're really good.
Cool.
All right, you heard it here, folks. A group of scholars. Just send them all.
Yep. Send them off with their short swords and crosswords. They love it.
Could you be a savage scholar?
You absolutely could be a savage scholar, and all you need to do is start looking at the ceiling and think about how that would work when you've got your next campaign.
That's right. Everything is in cave paintings, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to finally get to chat with you, and hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.